Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
You know, the smallmouth bass is the native trout in the Midwest. You know, if you follow what I'm saying there. And it's not, it just, we don't have the cold water to support extensive trout populations, but we've got thousands of miles of river smallmouth fishing, which is arguably as fun a game as trout fishing.
That was Jerry Darkus clarifying which species is actually the native trout of the Midwest. This is episode 170 of the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today. We'll help you on your fly fishing journey with classic stories covering steelhead fishing, fly tying, and much more.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Jerry Darkus, one of the biggest names in Great Lakes fly fishing, is here to share some tips on swinging flies for Great Lakes steelhead. We dig into some of the specifics on with a little bit on the St. Mary's River, the Grand, and other popular rivers and lakes in the Midwest. We also hear about some of the best resources for Great Lakes steelheading and break down the switch rod gear you need to be successful and get started today. I love when Jerry describes in this one the technique of swinging a fly off the ledge and into the slot. You can't miss that one. So without further ado, here's Jerry Darkus. How's it going, Jerry?
Going good, Dave. Thanks. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on here. We're going to dig into a little bit on just, I guess, the Great Lakes. Kind of focus on, you know, that's an area you've been, you know, you're pretty, your name is pops up a lot with a lot of the people I talk to, and I get some feedback from, you know, people out in your neck of the woods. But before we dig into that, can you just talk about how you first got into fly fishing and all the steelhead? Because I think, is that still your focus, steelhead fishing?
I do a lot of steelhead fishing seasonally, but there's a couple buddies of mine in that. We're starting to do a lot more fly fishing out in the main lakes themselves, which is very interesting. A lot of saltwater type situations we run into there. But, you know, from in the fall of the year and then, you know, through a big chunk of the spring, steelhead's certainly the primary focus. You know, so, but I, you know, I've been at this game a long time. You know, I'm in my mid 60s and, you know, have fly fished since I was about 10 years old. And my original inspiration, believe it or not, going way back, was the old American Sportsman TV show, which was on ABC many, many, many years ago. So that's kind of what got my interest going, and it took a while to really find anything in Ohio at that time point. But, you know, I did get hooked up with a few guys that opened up a little shop in my area, and as they say, the rest is history.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. The American Sportsman, I mean, after doing this show, you know, with, you know, I think we're over 160, 170 episodes now. I mean, it's come up quite a bit. You know, obviously, especially people, you know, from your generation. I mean, is there anybody, I mean, what else right now do you think is out there that's like the American Sportsman? Is there anything equivalent, or was it that just such a unique thing back in the day?
You know, there's, I guess what made that unique is it was the only show, you know, that covered all types of fishing, you know, bird hunting, duck hunting, big game hunting. It was all in one, you know, under one banner, where now everything's, you know, super specialized, and you can go you know, just about anywhere and find some sort of a TV show or something on YouTube focused on a really, you know, specific subject. So, I, you know, that the American Sportsman Show was definitely, I think, unique in that aspect. There just really was nothing like it. And really, I can't think of anything that's really like it at this point either.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Everything is so, it's very niche down, right? I mean, there's a lot of ultra niches, even the magazines, some of them are kind of in their own niche. So yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think it's better for some, you know, today, because if you want to focus on just, you know, whatever it is, right, you could find that little group probably out there.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting too. And, I'm already going off subject.
Oh yeah. Go for it.
But you know, even back, in when I was growing up, high school, college, and all that kind of stuff, you know, we did things kind of seasonally also, you know, where, you know, whatever was going on, whatever was the hot thing at that point is what we did. But now, you know, we've got guys that, you know, the only thing they do is strip streamers. You know, the only thing they do is, you know, Euro nymph or something like that. Or like the only way they want to fish for steelhead is to swing flies, you know. So again, just that, I think the shows, the magazines reflect a lot of that, where, you know, there's this just super specialization, you know, throughout the sport. And I'm not saying that's good or bad. It's just the way it's evolved at this point.
Yeah. And I think part of that comes back to, you know, like the business side, I'll bet you, you know, because in, you know, kind of in business, you know, sure. I'm sure, you know, the more niche you are to a certain degree, the kind of the better that is for your business, right? Because you become the leader in that space. I think of, like you said, Euro Nymphing, we've had probably, oh, I don't know, 6 or 10 episodes just on Euro Nymphing, and those people that, you know, have been on, have written books, and they're the books on, right? They're the people you think about, and I'm sure you know them. So, and now when you started out, so, I mean, you're obviously, you're diverse, you've done it all, but when you started out, were you kind of ultra, well, you said you did a lot of things throughout the year, but when you started your business, take us to that point. I mean, how did you get to where you had a business in fly fishing?
Now I got to really think back a little. You know, when I got out of school, I got a degree in like dual degree, chemistry, biology. I worked in the environmental industry for, close to 10 years. And that was okay. But that went through a bunch of consolidations, bigger companies buying smaller companies, et cetera. And I had a couple unpleasant transitions in that. And, you know, I'd always kind of at that point begun to specialize more and more in fly fishing as I got, you know, into college in that. And I actually originally got tied up or not involved, let's put it that way, doing some stuff with the St. Croix Rod Company when they were really first starting to get a little more active in the fly fishing area. And I ended up going to some of the early fly tackle dealer shows, helping them out. And with that contact, I was offered a sales rep position with a group of companies, you know, here in the Midwest. And, you know, that's how I started into the rep thing. And then kind of at that same time period was when, at least, you know, in my area, in the Lake Erie area, the steelhead or migratory rainbows, if we want to refer to them as that, had really started to come on the scene. And I was, at least in Ohio, I was one of the first guys to really focus on learning how to catch them on a fly. I had done a little bit of steelhead fishing up in Michigan prior to that. But I kind of dove in head first and really deep into the Lake Erie stuff when that started off. So,
nice.
It was at the early stages of that, in the Ohio tributaries for sure.
Okay. And what is the, to somebody who doesn't know the Great Lakes at all, I mean, I want to dig into Lake Erie and some of your home waters, but can you give us like a kind of a quick primer, maybe not to go in a huge detail, but just on, you know, the lakes and maybe the few big streams. So if we start at Lake Erie, you know, when you think of names, what are the big, what is the big stream or what is the place people are going for steelhead there?
Well, you know, if we start at Ohio, you know, these are going to be the southernmost of the Great Lakes tributaries. You know, we've got like our largest tributary on the South Shore is the Grand River. But we've got a couple good urban streams that mm-hmm. are very productive. You know, Rocky River, Chagrin River. Going out east, you've got like Conneaut Creek, which flows through both Ohio and Pennsylvania. Then you jump over into Pennsylvania. Elk Creek is really the primary stream there. You get into York, you've got Cattaraugus Creek, mm-hmm. Which is on the south shore of the lake, probably the largest drainage of any of the Lake Erie tributaries. And that's a great river to swing flies in. Probably the one negative, especially on the South Shore streams and Lake Erie streams in general, is that they're all precipitation influenced, you know, spate streams. So water levels are up and down. And trying to pick the correct flow to swing flies or do something, you know, it makes it undependable to a certain extent, but adds to the challenge of it to a certain extent too. So you're constantly adjusting depending on water levels and water clarities and things like that.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you got to keep up on it. And for the Lake Erie, what is your main river there that you're fishing? Your kind of your home water.
You know, my two favorites would be the Grand and Conneaut Creek. Those two, you can typically again. This is especially if you want to swing flies. Between those two, you can generally hop back and forth, most of the time, especially in the main fishing periods, you know, you'll find conditions that are suitable to swing a fly. Mm-hmm. If you want to throw nymphing, you know, indicators and stuff into the mix, the smaller rivers certainly come into play. So it's all a matter of just watching stream flows and mm-hmm. clarity and, you know, the fly size and color varies with all of that. And, you know, it's all part of the game. What makes it really fun.
Yeah. Where do you go for stream flows? Do you have a specific site you look at?
You know, there's been a couple of them on and off seem to have come and go. I don't go to one single site at this point. Yeah. I just go to the ES flows.
Sure.
And that, you know, makes it simple. Got them all loaded on my phone. So, you know, it just one push of the button and I'm ready to roll.
I do the same thing. Okay. And then...
Yep.
So I want to dig into specifically some more, you know, maybe on one of those rivers. But maybe you could just talk again about, so you cover steelhead. What other species throughout the year are you fishing for?
We do a lot of smallmouth bass fishing. And what's kind of a unique phenomenon that, you know, very few people really know about is that a lot of the Great Lakes tributaries, not just the Lake Erie tribs, get migratory runs of smallmouth bass in the spring. And, you know, these are a certain population of fish that come in and spawn in the tributaries. I'm sure it's a protective mechanism in case lake conditions are not good. You know, there is still at least the possibility of a successful spawn form. But pretty much all the tribs on the South Shore get those migratory runs of smallmouth. So we get this kind of interesting overlap for about a month in the spring where, I mean, you can go out on a given day and, you know, swing up a steelhead or two and, you know, some big lake-sized smallmouth to go along with them. So it makes it kind of fun. But, you know, and we fish smallmouth out in the main lake. Freshwater drum are coming on the scene, which are just a great fly rod fish. They get a bad rap or have for a long time. It's kind of like the carp scene was, you know, a number of years ago.
Yeah.
But freshwater drum really hit flies aggressively, and they get big. You know, you get a lot of fish up into that 8 to 10 pound range in certain places, even bigger in some areas. And you can find them in the shallows and sight fish to them, or you can fish over structure with sinking lines and streamers. And, you know, they just add a really interesting mix of things. And depending where you're at, you know, across, you know, various places of the lakes and that, you know, you've got largemouth bass in the mix, northern pike and muskie are a big deal in certain places. So
that's right.
You know, the whole thing is has expanded out, you know, as far as the species that you can chase. And there's a lot of walk and wade opportunities. There's kayak, canoe, there's small boat, you know. So you've got a lot of different scenarios, as well as, you know, pier and break walls at times too. So, again, this whole explosion in fly lines in, say, 20 years or so has just brought so much water within reach now that we didn't have previously. So, it, you know, it's been a good thing, you know, because it's opened a huge area for fly fishing that, you know, was not considered conventional fly fishing water in the past.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and I love that. I love the fact that, you know, the line, and I know you, maybe we'll talk about some of the companies you work with here eventually, but it's funny though, because I just interviewed Adrian Cortez, who's a steelhead fisherman out in the kind of Oregon, and he exclusively fishes dry lines in the winter for steelhead and a lot of dry fly stuff, but wet fly, you know, so he takes, you know what I mean? So it's like the extreme version of some of the steelheading. So he actually uses, you know, bamboo, and it's more of a throwback, ties in hand and all that stuff. So.
No, I was going to say, I know a few guys like that. Yeah. You know,
What separates those guys that are like that from the guys that maybe are more of the, you know, want to use all the heavy lines getting down, or just kind of, is there much difference between, you know, what I always wonder that, why would you want to put yourself where you're catching less fish?
Well, I guess it's kind of like making it as challenging as possible.
Yeah.
You know, evolving from, it's kind of the whole scenario when you first start out, you want to catch any fish. And then you want to catch a lot of fish. And then, you know, as you progress, well, you're going to focus on big fish. And then I think that's kind of like the final stage in the whole process where, you know, I want to catch a fish by this particular method, you know, with this particular equipment. And if I don't, that's okay. But when I do, it's, you know, kind of like the coolest thing ever.
Yeah, so, that's right. That's perfect. When you think about all these fish species, you know, you've written a couple books. I think you have a new one coming out. I mean, what do you love to talk about most when you just think of on fly fishing? Is there a topic that you really just kind of get extra excited about?
Yeah, you know, I love the steelhead game, you know, and I did it here, you know, almost from the start. I certainly wasn't the first person to fish for them, but, you know, been doing that game for close to 40 years. And we know there's a whole lot of people doing it now. And there's a lot of really good people doing it now. I mean, I think you've probably had a number of them, you know, on in the past out of this area here. I think what really gets me going personally, you know, at this stage of the game is really opening up the door on the big lake stuff. Whether it be, you know, the tributaries are part of that, but, you know, there's so many river mouths that you can fish, you know, connecting waters, you know. We can look at the Niagara River. We can look at the St. Mary's River. in some of those places like that, which are, you know, they're rivers, but they're huge, but they connect the lake. So they're almost like extensions of a lake. But if you take the Niagara River, for example, you know, you can, I've caught a number of steelhead there swinging a two-hander from shore, you know, so you have that opportunity. You can swing a two-hander from a boat in the Niagara River, you know, and you can do that while everybody around you that's fishing is bumping spawn bags or using quick fish or something like that. And you can still catch fish, you know, St. Mary's River, you know, has got from the Canadian side, you know, a short area that, that you can, wade, and it's got pretty much all wild, not native, but wild steelhead that return throughout much of the year, as well as additional species. Plus, you've got an opportunity for Atlantic salmon there, too. Mm-hmm. You know, so that makes that one pretty cool. And you get those swinging flies. And my buddy Jeff Liskay has caught Atlantics up there on dries, you know. So and other guys have done that also, you know, using traditional Atlantic salmon type techniques and that. So there's just so much out there that is available that is, I'm going to say, pretty much untouched from a fly fishing standpoint.
No kidding. So still to this day, I mean, like you said, you've been in it 40 years. It's still, there's places that fly fishing still isn't like the number one thing that you see people doing out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, kind of, and this is, again, going off track again is, you know, this whole, the Lake Erie in particular is famous for its walleye fishing, you know, and, and there are native species, they're supposed to be there, you know, so, and in the fall, there's a big migration of fish, following bait fishing as they move back in towards shore as the water cools off. And, of course it's a big deal to go out and throw gear for them, but you know, there's a few guys that are trying to crack the code on catching those fish consistently on flies. You know, so that type of stuff is, I think, really cool to try and go out and do that stuff and try and figure it out and come up with, hopefully come up with a style of fly or presentation or something that will allow you to consistently catch those fish. You know, so there's just, the lakes have a lot going on, you know, that a lot of people don't really even know about. And so at this stage, I guess, in my life or career, however you want to put it, that's a lot of what my focus is. You know, steelhead will always be the first love and everything like that. But, you know, trying to promote the lakes as more than just dragging lures around trolling or catching steelhead and a tributary, there's way much more than that that's out there that, again, is available. And as people do it, a lot of them are, it's like, hey, this is pretty cool. You know, wow, I didn't know we could do this, you know, that type of stuff. So
that's it.
You know, Lake St. Clair is another connecting water between Lake Huron and Lake Erie that has fabulous, you know, fly fishing in it. Average depth of the lake is 12 foot, you know, and it's an endless supply of gravel bars and rock piles and weed edges and stuff. And arguably the best musky lake, you know, there is right now, and smallmouth too.
And is this all in, I mean, you have a couple books there, I guess. Talk about your, is most of this covered in what was your first book? What's the title of that one?
It was called Fly Fishing the Inland Oceans.
Exactly. So in that book, I haven't read it, but it does that cover, I mean, we're having this conversation about all these amazing species and rivers. Do you kind of cover it all in that book?
I hit a lot of it. Yes. I mean, that was now the ground. A lot of that work was done about 10 years ago. The book's been out, I think, since 2013, something like that. So I know more now than I did then. But, you know, a lot of the stuff is covered in that book, yes. And at this point, there's a few more things I could add into the mix, maybe that weren't covered.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the basics and, well, it will be represented in there, certainly as far as the primary places to go and types of flies to use and you know, what fish where and when, and that kind of stuff is definitely there.
And then you also have a new book, right? Can you talk about your new book? I think more, is it more on the fly tying?
Well, it's got a lot of history of fly fishing in the region in it, as well as very specific on fly tying. Yes.
Okay. Let's take it there because I'm always interested in a little history. I mean, I do want to dig into a specific river and talk about swinging flies and or steelhead or what, you know, whatever we can dig into. But can you take us back to the history? Because we take you said 40 years, so that brings us back to maybe the 80s when you started steelhead fishing. Can you connect us in the Great Lakes to, you know, that history piece you're talking about? I mean, how far back are you going? And is it just the Great Lakes that you're talking about?
Well, yeah, in this last book I had, again, essential flies for the Great Lakes region. I actually go all the way back to the beginning stages of fly fishing in the area. You know, it originally, the first references are in the late 1700s and stuff. And, you know, there was talk in early 1800s of, you know, various aspects of it. But, you know, when things kind of really got going in the, you know, the Northeast, the Poconos, the Catskills in particular, Adirondacks, you know, we kind of look at that as the birthplace of fly fishing in the U.S. Well, the next place where, you know, the migration, so to speak, happened was in the Great Lakes area. And, you know, at that point, looking at the early to mid 1800s, you know, all travel was by boat for the most part. A really cool book that was published actually while the Civil War was going on. It's called Superior Fishing by Robert Barnwell Roosevelt, who I think ended up was kind of like distantly related to Theodore Roosevelt. But he wrote a book that Superior Fishing, among other things, documents a trip from like New York City and that up to the Nipigon River in Northwest Lake Superior. And this, at that time, that was a huge, huge adventure that took months. And they talk about stopping at the St. Mary's River at the rapids and then taking these, hauling all their gear up past the rapids and then taking a steamer, and they would stop and fish all these river mouths all the way across. You know, and they were after brook trout at that point, the lake dwelling brook called coasters. And again, you can go follow the course where, you know, the first book of the Black Bass by Henschel, which is the first really comprehensive reference to bass fishing and the first real bass bugs. That was the late 1800s. But, you know, a lot of the well-known fishermen out of the Catskills and that, they would go to Michigan to fish for the Michigan grayling. And when the railroads opened, that's what really, you know, brought people out there. And unfortunately, that also brought the logging industry and everything else, which ultimately wiped out the Michigan grayling. And, the native brook trout in a lot of areas, and that they were supplemented or, you know, replaced by brown trout, you know, which were stocked in the later 1800s. And Michigan was first place that brown trout were stocked in the U.S. And also the first place that rainbows were stocked in the Midwest, too. So, you know, there's a lot of firsts that come out of this area. And if we even go into the fly tying history, you know, looking into the 30s and 40s, the first parachute flies were tied out of this area. You know, the use of deer hair as a body material laid parallel to the hook shank was first out of this area. So, you know, so this whole region has been, you know, important in the development of not only fly fishing, but fly tying in particular. You know, if we look at, you know, the first really work on using streamers to target the biggest fish in the system. And that's Kelly Gallup and Bob Linzenman, 20, 25 years ago, something like that. So, you know, we've got this ongoing, continuous thing going. Gary Borgers from Wisconsin, Swisher Richards with selective trout. I mean, Ernie Schwiebert and nymphs, you know, so the list goes on and on and on, that this particular region was very important in the development of fly fishing as we know it today. The Adams dry fly, the muddler, the first terrestrial patterns, the Griffith's gnat, you know, a lot of the modern mainstays were developed in this area, you know. So that book kind of, you know, focuses briefly on that history. But then what I tried to do the various fly categories have been presented with, you know, some of the classic designs all the way through to the latest, you know, cutting edge type stuff that's out there now. Game changer, you know, which is not developed here, but certainly has, you know, a use in this area. Same thing with steelhead patterns too. The nymphing methods for steelhead, you know, probably really became an art form in this region. You know, whether you agree with it or not, you know, egg flies, nymph flies, and used in tandem. I mean, that's a major, major style of fly fishing here. But then now there's this growing group of steelheaders that are kind of going back to the traditional methods traditional style flies, or at least swinging streamer type patterns of local designs, as well as, you know, bringing in intruder style patterns. Mm-hmm. You look at somebody like, you know, you've talked to Kevin Feenster, you've talked to, I think, Pete Humphreys. So, you know, those guys, philosophies and that. And then you've got a younger man, you know, like Greg Senyo, who's kind of gotten his own twist on these intruder style patterns and, you know, almost created a little niche or genre all his own in the way he does stuff. So, it's cool. So a lot of stuff was developed here. You know, a lot of stuff has been adapted for the region here. The book is kind of covers all of that. And I do everything from, you know, small trout flies, midges and that are covered, up to the mega predator patterns, you know, for muskie and pike and that too. And everything in between is covered in there. So I've tried to get a good representative selection of those type of flies that, you know, cover the historical aspect of it, developmental stages and what's, you know, what's current up to the latest point right now.
No, that's cool. That's cool. Yeah, I love, a lot of the names you mentioned. I just had Kelly Gallup on recently, and, Gary Borger had him. I mean, that's a great thing. I always love having these conversations because I wonder, you know, how well I'm doing and, you know, covering things. Because, you know, obviously I'm in Oregon, but I'm trying to cover the whole country. You know, I get a lot of people from the Great Lakes that email me and say, hey, you know, can you get this person, you know, or this topic? Sure. So it's a hot spot for fly fishing for sure. And I always want to know that I'm doing well. And Greg Senyo I have coming on here in a couple of months, I think. And cool. You know what I mean? It's like, but it's hard to get to everybody. I mean, Swisher and Richards, obviously that's, I think Kelly noted that book. Those two guys, those guys have passed now? Is that?
Carl Richards has passed away. I think Doug Swisher is still alive.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
But, you know, then, you know, as far as some of the stuff that's happened on, you know, other sidelines, as far as, you know, really bringing smallmouth, you know, mm-hmm. into the whole mainstream, and that's a huge growth area in this region, because there's so much water, you know, from lakes, the big Great Lakes, to even small little tiny spring creeks that, you know, have smallmouth in them, but are just not quite cold enough to hold trout and stuff.
Do you think there's more people now smallmouth fishing out there than there are trout fishing, or is it kind of equal?
It depends. You know, it depends where you're at. What we do see is, you know, take place at, like, Indiana, for example, or parts of Ohio, where there'd be virtually no fly fishing or no river fly fishing if smallmouth weren't the equation.
Nope.
In parts of southern Michigan, look at, like, you know, I don't know, Mike Schultz in southern Michigan with his crew of guys, Tim Landwehr in Wisconsin, you know, you've got Chad Miller in Indiana and other guys, you know, so they've really brought the smallmouth game into the forefront, and they're taking advantage of a resource that's right in their backyards. And, you know, you can argue what's the better fish, but, you know, the smallmouth bass is the native trout in the Midwest. You know, if you follow what I'm saying there. And it's not, it just, we don't have the cold water to support extensive trout populations, but we've got thousands of miles of river smallmouth fishing, which is arguably as fun a game as trout fishing. And, you know, we talk about, we mentioned earlier before we even started about, you know, switch rods and stuff. Mm-hmm. Swinging a switch rod for smallmouth and maybe a gurgler on the end of it, or a little muddler or something like that, or other fly, that's about as much fun as it gets. I mean, I'm telling you, just yeah. If you're going looking to have a good time, you know, so it's adapting to what you have available, you know, and that's, I think, what, you know, what we're seeing is a big move in that direction.
Yeah, that's cool. Well, let's take it back. I mean, if we had to go to one river, you know, I always like to try to do this where I can, just to focus the conversation. I mean, I guess the St. Mary's kind of comes back to me, and I think I heard you talk about this before, but, you know, the St. Mary's has Atlantic salmon, like you said, and it's also kind of a river where it's, you know, the normal person can go there, right? You don't need thousands of dollars to go fish for Atlantic salmon. Is that something, you know, we might be able to dig into maybe a little bit on the St. Mary's?
Yeah, well, so there's two different things going on the St. Mary's. There's a couple power plants on the U.S. side, which really are only fishable by boat. There's a couple guides that work that area, you know, during kind of the prime seasons for that.
Just a couple?
Yeah, there, you know, there's really not many guys, at least on the U.S. side. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the only guy I know that's guiding fly fishermen regularly there is Brad Petsky out of Marquette, Michigan, or he's in the Marquette area. Mm-hmm. RiversNorth, I think, .net is his website. Very okay. Cool guy. And he's few fish fly fishing guides, period, on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. So the U.S. side is mainly a boat game.
Okay.
You know, you can... Obviously, anybody can take their boat in there, you know, and mess and, you know, try and figure it out. The Canadian side, you know, there is good wading access. The issue right now is having the border closed. Mm. Okay. So right now, you know, from the U.S., we can't go into Canada or anything like that. So that cuts out a lot of, you know, a lot of Great Lakes water.
That's right.
But it does shut off the wading section of the St. Mary's.
Oh.
Okay. So that's in limbo right now till we can get across the border again.
Yeah.
But there is a good stretch of the rapids there. I don't know. It's 3/4 mile long that, you know, you can easily park, and it's a short walk too. And, you know, there's fish there 365 days a year.
Yeah.
Some sort of a migratory salmonid of some sort. Hmm. You know, we've caught steelhead there in July. The Atlantics are in there all summer. And again, you get the seasonal migrations of the Pacific salmon.
Oh, right.
In, you know, and it was one of the first places where, you know, catching rainbows was first really featured. Back in the 1920s, when Hemingway was still a young writer, he had an article that he put in the Toronto paper about you know, the best rainbow trout fishing anywhere was in the rapids of the St. Mary's River, you know. So, and that's from the original stockings. It's all still wild fish and everything. So, you know, it's, you know, so that's certainly one area that, you know, is kind of unique in its own way. But, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, if we, again, kind of go back to the switch rod thing, gosh, there's so many cool little rivers.
That's right. Maybe we could talk about that. Maybe we just keep it a little more general and say, let's say somebody, you know, kind of, well, I know there are a lot of rivers, obviously, out there. That's the, maybe the difference is that there's a lot more of the smaller rivers where you could, a switch rod might be better for steelhead as compared to maybe out west where you have a lot of big rivers. But if we stick on the switch rod, just generally, can you talk about a little bit about what it takes to catch steelhead out there with a switch rod? Can we focus on swinging as well?
Sure. Well, you know, again, the thing about switch rods is, you know, you can adapt the style of fishing to the conditions or how, you know, you want to do it. You can easily indicator fish with them or, you know, you can swing flies with them. So that's what kind of makes them unique. You know, they're kind of a compromise between maybe the two ideal setups for either style of fishing, but, you know, they work well for, you know, both things. So that's kind of where they're in niching themselves. So there is a lot of, I suppose, what I would call more medium-sized streams, say Lake Erie, like a Conneaut Creek, something like that. New York, you know, even Salmon River.
Yeah.
You know, you can fish two-handers on the salmon, but you can certainly, you know, get by very well with a switch rod if you want to. You know, Michigan, on Lake Michigan side, gosh, look at the, you know, the Paramarquette.
Yeah.
Beautiful river. All wild, you know, all wild fish. That's a great switch rod river, as is on the east side, maybe like the Rifle River would be one I could think of. Wisconsin, maybe the Brule. You know, that's a Lake Superior stream.
All right.
So, you know, I mean, there's, you know, a couple of rivers for each of the lakes right there.
What is the, you know, if you're going to go with the switch rod, what's like the length, weight, kind of some of that stuff that you would recommend?
Yeah, okay. You know, I think if you're going to pick one, I'd probably go with somewhere like a 10 and a half or 11 foot, probably 8 weight, where you're throwing something in the 400-450 grain range, you know, as far as line. And so you have the ability to, you know, at least put some longer, heavier tips on if you need to. I know here, you know, on our tributaries, when the flows are good, we're usually fishing maybe 10 to 12 foot of the equivalent of like T10 or T12.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay. Whereas, you know, in the something like the Paramarquette, you know, for some of their deeper pools or something, you know, fast flow, good flow in that river, and some deep holes in that might, you know, go up and throw some T14 on, or even maybe a little shorter length of T18 if you can turn it over. You know, and so again, we often have to do a lot of adjustment with tips to kind of find the right feel on any given day. The multi-density tips certainly have their place.
So yeah, and then a rod. So, well, maybe we can just dig in just quickly on, because I know you rep a few companies. As far as if you're talking switch rods and this setup, you know, what rod, you know, kind of are you using, what brand, and then think talk, and also with lines.
Yeah, you know, so I work a lot with Scott rods. You know, they're T3, the T3H 11'8" is really a great all around rod, you know, to use anywhere throughout the Great Lakes. You know, it's just a very comfortable rod to fish, you know, handles fish well. You know, you don't pull a lot of hooks or anything with it on big fish. And then, you know, they're mid-price rods also, you know, do a nice job. We use the 11.5 foot 8 on that one quite a bit. And, you know, so that they make good rods. It's okay. A good company.
Yeah, yeah. Scott's a good company for sure. And then what about for a line?
Yeah, lines, we started, again, this is just, you know, for my personal, have been involved with, the Spey lights from Scientific Anglers have become super, super popular. You know, not only for tips, but even the Scandi versions of the line, you know, for indicator fishing and that, if you want to go that route. But if you're looking for a line to kind of do the whole package, you know, and not have all kinds of spools and things you have to carry with you, the SA and Adro line is actually a very good line to use too, because you can put fairly heavy tips on it if you have to, and it turns stuff over really, really well. It does have an extended belly and back for mending, again, for indicator fishing and stuff. So it may not shoot quite as well as, say, a Skagit style with a tip on it. But again, if you're looking for something to cover as many bases as possible, you know, without having a lot of extra things to carry with you, it'd be certainly something to consider.
Okay. Okay, perfect. And so that gets us in the ballpark for gear. And then, you know, if we take it to the river, you were talking about a medium-sized river. Can you just take us to that river, whichever one you're kind of is coming to your mind, and maybe talk about how to get started? I mean, is it different than if we're talking swinging? I mean, what are you putting on there? What's, you know, what type of water? How are you reading the water? That sort of thing.
Okay. Well, you know, from a swinging standpoint, a lot of, I think, you know, the color choices here are made based on water conditions. And, you know, spring and fall will be considerably different in a lot of areas. If I look at Conneaut Creek, for example, you know, the water will be fairly tannic still this time of year from all the leaves coming down. And again, I don't really get too excited about swinging flies until the leaves are off.
Okay.
You know, because we got tons of hardwoods here.
Yep.
You know, oaks and maples and everything. And when the leaves are coming off of them and you get a wind and, you know, everything's blowing into the river, it's kind of like,
crazy.
It can be, you know, yeah, it's just not fun.
No.
But once you get the leaves off, and, you know, you get a nice flow, and you can start using flies. Again, when water's fairly tannic, it seems stuff in the olives, with, you know, copper, maybe a mix of copper and chartreuse. Mm-hmm. You know, the greens and golds and copper mixes seem to work well in the tannic colored waters, in a lot of cases. You know, all black is, you know, some days, you know, just a hard one to beat. You can blend black with, you know, a brighter color. Mm-hmm. Purple and chartreuse can be a good one too, at times, you know, because that's visible, you know, under a wide range of color conditions. So, you know, that's always a good back pocket color to have. And that's, I often fish that right off the bat, purple in chartreuse mixes. So, you know, that's a good one to hang on to. But once things, you know, through the winter and when the water starts to, we call it, the water starts to green up a little bit. So
we have this, at least on these state streams here, and again, we have a lot of these in the Great Lakes, but this particularly prevalent, you know, on the Lake Erie and probably the South Shore, Lake Ontario, again, where similar streams are present, and you got a lot of hardwoods in that. After you get a couple good flushes of rain, you know, a lot of that tannic color washes out, and the water does what we call it, it greens up. Whereas the deeper pools and stuff will start to get this really nice emerald green color to them. And, you know, there the, you know, fly colors can change a little bit under those conditions. We'll start to fish it, or start, you know, we'll start to use a lot more bait fishy looking patterns often. You know, the olives and stuff, you know, that'll still work. Black is always a good choice. Brighter colored stuff, whites, combinations of white and blue, white and chartreuse, you know, that will come into the mix more under those conditions. And when we're talking about good clarity in our streams, you know, again, on the South Shore Lake Erie, we're looking at anywhere from probably 18 to 30, 20 to 36 inches of visibility. You know, in the smaller rivers, those fish will be very, very comfortable in those conditions, but, you know, they can certainly see a fly extremely well. And a lot of the spots we're fishing are not, you know, they're not super long runs. You know, we just don't have that type of stuff in, you know, in the area where I'm at. Whereas a good pool or a good run might be 100 feet long, mm-hmm. you know, something like that, you know, instead of 100 yards long. So, you know, there's often a lot more moving throughout the course of the day from spot to spot. Once you fish through an area, you know, if you're convinced there's fish there, you know, you should go through maybe with a different fly color, something like that. You know, that's kind of a, you know, certainly a traditional way to do that type of fishing. But, you know, if you've, you know, hit an area and you feel like, okay, there's not one there, you know, there's not one that's going to play, then it's time to move on. The other thing is, historically, there's not been a lot of floating done on these rivers until recently. It was almost all walk and wade stuff. Now, some of the newer rafts that are on the market now, you know, the fly crafts, Smith Fly, you know, the similar stuff like that. We're starting to see a lot of rafts and that, and, you know, more guides and more guides in rafts and things like that. So, but, you know, the ability to move is certainly works in your advantage, on the waters here. You know, a lot of what we have here is shale ledges, and the fish will lay really tight to those ledges at times. So getting the fly to drop off that ledge very quickly is often a key to success. Mm-hmm. And here, you know, a combination of a tip with a fly with some weight, you know, can certainly help you out. The problem is if you, you know, get too fast of a drop off the ledge and you start to swing and then, you know, you're hung up on the bottom. So, getting everything balanced correctly, can be a challenge, especially under, you know, colder water temperatures when the fish are just not that willing to move to take a fly. Hmm. So, you know, challenging, or, you know, it's a challenging game here, to swing flies and catch fish, you know, consistently. You know, there's periods of time where the smaller rivers, you know, will ice up, they'll cover right over. So, at that point, you know, you're out of the game, or, you know, you look for bigger water somewhere to go to.
Right.
Because there are places that, you know, rarely do freeze, but, you know, you're going to be fishing water that's 34 degrees, you know, that type of stuff.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, the swing game is definitely challenging.
Yeah.
But again, that's kind of what makes it fun.
Yeah, that's what makes it
fun. So.
What percentage, if you think roughly, just guesstimating, you know, percentage of people are swinging versus kind of using nymphs and fly fishing?
You know, I'd say we're probably, you know, there's a lot of guys that will go back and forth depending on conditions.
Yeah.
But as far as hardcore swing guys, and that's the only way they want to do it, out of the fly fishing crowd at this point, I don't know, I'm going to guess 25%, 30%, maybe up to a third of them. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a fair number of people. You know, I think, and again, that varies depending where you're at around the lakes to a certain extent too.
Yeah.
But you know, it's a reasonable percentage of people that want to, you know, fish that way.
Okay. And what was your, and without giving away any secrets, is there a river in your, I don't know if it's a, there's a Lake Erie river you mentioned at the start that would be good with the switch rod? I guess you're looking at size,
well,
or are you just looking at size? You're kind of thinking size mainly, like width of river?
Yeah, just mainly the size of the river and that. You know, again, I think I, you know, mentioned the Pere Marquette being a great one in Michigan. You know, here in Ohio, you know, the Grand River is a good one. Conneaut Creek is another good one for that style of fishing.
Yeah, Conneaut.
You know, the Grand in Ohio, you can fish a full two-hander at times, but again, that's a river where when the flows are right, often it's got a high sediment load to it. So again, just finding that open window is always the challenge. That would be the same thing for Cattaraugus Creek in New York also. That river drains a lot of the ski areas in the highlands there in western New York. Plus, it's right in the middle of the snow belt, you know, where the lake effect snows are, you know, often the heaviest that they get. So any little melt, you know, can just throw the whole thing out of whack. So you can plan a trip, you know, for next year on November 10th or whatever the date is right now, and you just don't have either enough water to fish it, or you might have too much water to fish it, you know. So you have to be very adaptable and, you know, willing to adjust in order to stay in the fish, you know, consistently.
Gotcha. Okay. And going back, I just think about the rod. So if you mentioned an 8 weight, is a 6 weight, 11.5 foot 6, is that a little too light, or does that work for some areas?
You know, it's fine if you can turn over the tips that you need.
Oh, that's the big thing, the tips. Because sometimes, like you said, the Conneaut Creek is that one where you might need some real heavy stuff to get down pretty quick?
No, Conneaut, you can often use lighter stuff. And there, you know, the 6 weight is fine.
Okay. And can you spell that? Most of the time. Can you spell the name of that one?
Conneaut.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha. All right.
Yep. You know, so again, I would err on the heavier side if I was going to pick, you know, one rod to use rather than, you know, having something that's too light where it can't turn over the flies or turn over the chips that are needed.
Eight weight is kind of more, or would a seven weight be an all around, or is the 8 more of your all around for just Great Lakes?
Well, 7 or 8, but if I look at again some of the larger rivers, like should I say rivers with more flow, again like a Pere Marquette or something like that, there you might find that the 8's going to be a more usable tool, you know, just because of the need for probably heavier tips and things like that, but you know, 7 or 8 probably suitable in just about any situation.
Gotcha. Okay. And I'm just trying to paint the picture, you know, trying to, and anybody listening, to help understand what we're talking about here. I mean, I've had a ton of steelhead episodes, and you know, we've talked a lot about this, but I think it's interesting because we haven't talked about the switch rods that much. It seems like a lot of people are using, at least out west, using kind of the bigger stuff, and even some of the really big stuff, right? Guys are going old school, traditional. So it's cool. Yep. I mean, I think the switch rod, and also the switch rods, it seems like they almost get it's almost like that name is going away as well. You know, it seems like, do you still hear, are people still calling them? I mean, is switch rod still a thing out there, or is there a different name for
it? Yeah, they call them switch rods. You know, when it comes to that type of stuff, we tend to lag about, I'm going to say, 2 years behind on what's, you know, going on the West Coast and that. It's the way it's always been.
Yeah.
You know,
it's still the same. So wherever we're at right now, you guys will be cut. Well, I mean, some of it, I guess the Grand, are guys using big 15 foot rods out there at all? The big stuff back of the old.
Yeah, not so much 15s, not for practical fishing rods, but you know, a lot of 13 to 14 foot stuff.
Yeah. So they're using
when flows are up.
That's right.
Yep. Sure.
Okay, Jared. Well, I think we're going to get out of here pretty quick, but before we do, maybe we can just take it out with the 222, which is the top two tips, top two flies, and top two resources. And, you know, we've covered, I love this because we've been covering it. We've covered a lot of the Great Lakes. Obviously, you know more about it, but we, in one short hour-long episode, we can't, you know, cover it all. So focusing it again back down to steelhead, if we take it to that little medium-sized creek, we got a you know, a switch rod, we're trying to find a steelhead. Maybe we've never hooked a steelhead on the swing out there, but would you have a couple of, let's just start with the flies. What would be two flies? You said the green. Are there a specific names of flies you might put on there first?
I would say what we need is we need a dirty water fly and a clear water fly.
Okay.
You know, and a dirty water fly is going to be big. You know, Jeff Liske has, who's a very well-known guy out of this area, and that's probably somebody you should get on at some point, too. You know, he does just a kind of generic, maybe Arctic fox with a lot of, you know, different flash in it. But he'll put, for example, he'll do like a black with a flame orange laser dub head on it, you know, in like a veil. And then a clear water version might be, you know, an olive one with a little bit of chartreuse at the head or something like that. Because, you know, most of our fish, if they're feeding, are feeding on bait fish. Yeah, we don't have a huge, at least, again, I'm talking about the South Shore, Lake Erie streams. We don't have, you know, we've got some, we've got black stones, we've got golden stones, we've got some caddis, but they're full of emerald shiners and different shiner species and creek chubs and stuff like that. So that, you know, if there is a natural food base in there, a lot of it is going to be, you know, bait fish based. So, but I would say you need a dirty water fly. You need a clearer water fly, and you can talk to 10 different guys and you're going to get 10 different opinions on what's best.
Perfect.
Okay. If I had to pick one fly to use under all conditions, again, I think I mentioned this earlier, I would fish like probably a purple with like a chartreuse head. And that chartreuse head, and it can be a rapid strip wing. It can be, you know, Arctic fox or something similar like that, but with a laser dub or ice dub head on it and varying amount of flash depending on, you know, actual water clarities and things like that.
Yeah.
I fish a lot of tubes, personally. Mm-hmm. And I know Jeff fishes a lot of tubes, too. You know, just for the ability of being able to adjust the hook location and things like that. So, but I, you know, if I had to pick one color, that might certainly be one I would consider.
Yeah.
You know, and again, here, the standard tip length, if we have good flow to swing flies, you know, we're looking at generally about, say, 10 to 12 foot of a T10 or T12.
That's it. Okay. Perfect. No, it gives,
okay. You know, again, this is narrowing it down as lean as you could possibly get it. You know, and we're often, you know, running straight 15 pound right off the tip. You know, off generally, you know, 3 to 4 feet, 15 pound off the tip. In real cold water, you might shorten that up to a foot to keep the fly as close to the bottom as you can. If there is a little more clarity to the water, you know, and it's a little warmer, you could lengthen that out to maybe 5-6 foot at times.
Yeah, perfect. And what about a couple of tips? If, again, if we're on the water there, we're trying to find a steelhead. What would you have a couple of tips that might help somebody if they had this set up?
Well, again, if you can, if you've got enough visibility to see where the ledges are, and look for, well, let's put it this way. Warmer temperatures, especially in the fall this time of year, the fish are going to be either right up at the head of the pool, even sometimes right in the, you know, the fast white water, and they'll be in the, maybe all the way down to the bucket. So they'll be in the front half, front third of the pool. Coldest conditions in the winter, they're going to be, all the fish are going to be in the deepest part of the pool in the bucket. Okay. Once we get towards spring and we've got spawning activity going on, the majority of our fish are winter run spring spawners. You're looking at the fish are going to be, in a lot of cases, they'll be, you know, starting to go into the back part of the pool, you know, where the tail outs,
yep.
Where there's gravel and stuff more. So at that point, you might be looking at, you know, the bucket back to the tail out then. So you can kind of, you know, you've got those three parts of the pool. You know, if you want to, again, just do a very generic breakdown, but very rarely will you find fish in all three spots on a given day.
Gotcha.
Okay. They're going to be in, they're going to be in two of the three typically, and sometimes only one of the three.
Yeah. Okay?
So that, you know, basically breaking down a pool based on season and water temperature, I think, is an important thing to learn.
That's great. That's a great tip. So, so if, again, we're there, we're fishing, it's kind of this time of year, which is November-ish or whatever, the before it gets too cold, you might be hitting the upper part of that run. And then would there be another another tip you throw out there to help somebody as they're swinging? I mean, is it just pretty much cast down and across and throw a mend in it to get it down? Anything else you'd mention?
Yeah, I mean, you know, don't be afraid to really step down and to, you know, to allow a fly to drop in tight along a ledge or in structure. Or, you know, we always have this whole thing where you can, you're told always hold the tip of the rod down and, you know, into the water. Well, it might be that for the first part of the swing, while everything's settling, you know, you can actually hold the rod up fairly high. But when you get into that spot, especially coming off, trying to drop off a ledge or that type of thing, just instead of maybe doing a step back, drop the rod tip at that point.
Oh, yeah.
So, so that fly will drop, you know, it'll kind of wave a little bit, and then it'll get that, you know, once it tightens up again, it's going to take off. And that'll often, you know, that that's often the trigger right there.
That's cool.
To get a hit. Especially in smaller, you know, in smaller spots like that, that's a really, I think a really good trick to have in your bag. The other thing is to, again, make sure you let the fly swing in tight, and before you pick it up to recast, give it a couple strips.
Oh, okay. Yep. So
a lot of times they'll follow it in, and you know, you're going to get, especially, you know, with these bait fish patterns and that, you'll get, you know, you'll get a certain amount of fish that hit, you know, on a strip on the way in.
That's right. And this would be more down, is this at the hang down or before the hang down?
Yeah. Kind of on the hang down. Yep.
On the hang down. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. Those are killer tips. So, and then what about resources? We talked about your books there at the beginning. You've got a couple of probably some of the best resources, but any other thing, you know, books, magazines, websites, anything that comes to mind that would be a good resource if somebody wants to, you know, learn more about switch or spay or steelhead fishing there?
Oh gosh, there is, where do you start?
Is there a lot?
Oh yeah, there's tons of stuff out there. I mean, if you start looking up, you know, Great Lakes steelhead fishing and that, you're going to be, there's going to be tons of stuff out there. Now, Rick Kustich has a couple books out.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, that, that deal specifically on steelhead,
yep.
I think he's got three books out now, and I think the last one was pretty much all swung fly stuff. So certainly Rick's stuff is a great, great resource. There's another book out there, John Nagy's Lake Erie Steelhead Guide, which is, you know, which is just, you know, location type of information, not specifically the swung flies or anything like that. I know Kevin just had a book come out also. On bait fish patterns for steelhead. It literally just hit the shelves like last week.
Who are, so you mentioned Rick Kustich, Jeff Liskay, Kevin Feenstra, John Nagy. I mean, those are probably, when I think of, you know, names, those are huge, and as well as yourself. I mean, these are five names that always come up when you think of Great Lakes. Is there anybody else, you know, is there a bunch of other people that should be on that list, or are you guys kind of the
Well, you know, there's certainly, you know, guys that are on the water a ton. You know, that these days that fish a lot. Now, you know, out of the Ohio area, you know, John Fabian is a great guide. You know, there's Senio's old company, Steelhead Alley Outfitters, is a great group of guys.
There's plenty.
I know I'm going to forget somebody.
Yeah, no, we don't want to nail
them off.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to nail you down for that. That's good.
But there's tons of resources out there. There's great guides. There's a shop in Cleveland here, Chagrin River Outfitters, that has some good guys that work out of it. There's a lot going on here, but Jeff is certainly probably the most well known out of the Lake Erie guys. That's who I got my start from.
Oh, cool.
Steelhead fishing.
Oh, cool.
So Jeff kind of got me going in it. So I would say if there's the best all around resource in this area, that's probably who it would be.
It's Jeff. Yeah. Okay, good. Okay. Well, yep. That's perfect. I mean, obviously there's a bunch of other things we could have dove into here, but I love that we dug into a little bit on the history and it sounds like your current book that's just come out has some of that history. So I'll put links to the show notes to your books and everything we talked about here. Anything in the next 6 to 12 months, anything else you got coming that's new other than your book that you want to give a highlight here?
I got a couple things going out. I think I'll have some stuff in this next edition of Fly Tire magazine.
Oh, nice.
The winter edition, I've got some stuff coming in. And then American Fly Fishing, there is a Western End of Lake Erie piece coming out. So those should be out, anytime. And a few other things in the works now, but not at completion at this point.
Gotcha.
Yet.
Okay. And also on the reps, we didn't go dig into it. I mean, how many companies do you rep just in general? Is there just a bunch or just a few?
Well, I'm out of the rep game.
Oh, you are.
Yeah. So I sold that business, first of the year, to a fellow by the name of Phil Cook, who worked at Scientific Anglers. So, 30 years on the road was kind of enough. Yeah, so what I'm doing now is I'm doing some marketing support work for Scientific Anglers. I'm on the Scott Pro staff. I'm kind of ramped up the writing stuff a little bit and just kind of taking it easy a little bit, too.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
I had a bunch of trips planned for this year, this summer and everything that got scrubbed because of the whole COVID thing.
Uh-huh.
So I'm hoping I can get those in next year.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's awesome. It sounds like you're kind of in the, getting towards more of like a retirement phase. Is that kind of where you're headed?
Yeah, quasi-retirement, yeah, but not quite.
But not quite. What's the, and I think a lot of people that I talk to, it's like nobody ever quite retires that are, have a history like yourself.
Right.
I mean, with 30 years on the road, I mean, the repping thing, what is the... what is the best thing? What's the most memorable? What do you love about doing that for 30 years?
Being able to meet and actually help and educate people.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that a lot. And, I did a lot of guiding in that time period, too.
Oh, okay.
Kind of seasonally guiding, especially here. On the trips here.
Yeah.
Kind of seeing that guy get his first fish, first steelhead, no matter what technique, or then again, getting it first one on a swing or something like that. But even just being able to help people out, help them select equipment. The other aspect is, being involved with some of these top tier companies and, having input on product and development and helping in development I really enjoyed that.
That's awesome.
And then just the whole networking throughout the whole industry and everything, a lot of cool people.
That's the reason. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the reason we're talking here. It's your name has definitely been out there for a while, and it's good to hear. I love connecting the history pieces, and that's, here we've done that a little bit. So I guess, yeah, if anybody has questions for you, I think it sounds like on Instagram, is it just Jerry Darkus on Instagram?
Yep, that's it.
Okay, perfect. I'll put a link to that, Jerry. Hey, thanks for coming on and taking the time. I know you got to run to pick up your wife there, so I appreciate you hanging here and taking us out of here and all the work you've done over the years. It's definitely, you know, it's a great resource, and I appreciate everything you've done.
Okay. Well, Dave, I appreciate you getting a hold of me and having me on, and it was a lot of fun, and maybe one of these days we'll bump into each other somewhere. So
yeah, I planned on coming out there. So hopefully I'll see you out in your neck of the woods.
Okay. Take care. Thanks.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes with all the links we cover, just go to wetflyswing.com/170. I would love if you could take a minute and leave a quick rating and review for this show. If you go to wetflyswing.com/love, love will get you there. Love is the answer. There's a page there that will redirect to your app of choice, and it would be great. I'm not sure on Apple. We've got a number of reviews, but I'm not sure which app you use. If you want to give me a heads up, send a DM over on Twitter. That's WetFlySwing on Twitter, and let me know what app you're listening on. That would be cool. I can track down which episode you're loving and you're listening to, and I can connect with you a little bit further there. Thanks again today for stopping by the show. I'm looking forward to catching up with you soon. I hope to maybe see you online or on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com. And if you found this episode helpful, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes.